From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And today, House Republicans concluded their two-year investigation into the 2012 terror attacks in Benghazi, Libya. They released an 800-page report criticizing Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State during the attacks. Democrats say the report offers no new evidence of wrongdoing. The chairman of the commission, Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy, today disputed that.
There is new information on what happened in Benghazi. And that information should fundamentally change the way you view what happened in Benghazi. And there are recommendations made to make sure it does not happen again.
Joining us now with more on this and some of the other news from the campaign trail is Domenico Montanaro, lead political editor at NPR. Hi, Domenico.
Good afternoon.
So Democrats say there's nothing new here. He says there is something new here. What's in the report?
Well, when it comes to Hillary Clinton, Trey Gowdy was said that this was not necessarily a report about Secretary Clinton. He said that that's a creation of the media and of Democrats being obsessed with Clinton. There were a couple of news items out of this that didn't really relate to Secretary Clinton. It was more about how there were clear orders from the President of the United States and the Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, to have planes leave from Spain to go to Libya to try to help in back up with the lack of security that's already been known, and that those planes sat on runways for hours. We learned that the Libya military intelligence, which was an arm of the Gaddafi regime, were actually fighting off the attackers when the U.S. security forces wound up leaving. So this situation kind of created strange company, but it really had more to do with the military, it seemed, than it did as focused on Secretary Clinton. Now, I will say that there was a split among the some of the members of the committee, Representative Pompeo and Jordan. They put out their own report that was much more focused on Clinton that apparently Trey Gowdy did not want to include in his larger report.
What is the likely impact on the Clinton campaign right now?
Well, without the Benghazi investigation, first of all, we would never have known about the private email server that Secretary Clinton used. Now, that was already known, obviously, as we've been litigating that for a year and a half or so. And Hillary Clinton, it has been one of the things that has been undermining her candidacy already. So that's something she's been having to deal with. So as far as anything changing the course of the campaign, it doesn't appear that this report would do so.
I want to ask you about the Donald Trump campaign, because there have been reports on CNN and in the Wall Street Journal that Trump is moderating his blanket ban on Muslim immigration to this country. Let's listen, first of all, to what he said in December.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Now, Katrina Pearson, a Trump national spokeswoman, said on CNN yesterday that the campaign was refining the proposal, putting out more details, but insisted that the proposal was not going to change. Here she is.
You know, I know the news media has been reporting that the initial ban was against all Muslims, and that simply was not the case. It was simply for Muslim immigration. And Mr. Trump is simply adding specifics to clarify what his position is, as opposed to what the media has been reporting what it is. There has been no change to this. Mr. Trump still wants to stop individuals from coming into this country who cannot be vetted.
Domenico, explain.
Well, I think that's perfectly clear. You don't need me to say anything. Look, I mean, the fact is that was completely, not clear. I mean, the Muslim ban that he was proposing was for people coming to the United States, not Muslims who are in the United States, obviously. He called it a temporary ban. He then expanded on those remarks, saying that in later comments in his national security address a couple weeks ago, that people from countries with a history of terrorism would not be allowed in. So people were wondering, did that mean that he was saying now anybody from places like Northern Ireland or even Belgium couldn't come to the United States? Or was he talking about Muslim countries or Muslims from those countries? Nobody exactly knows. What CNN apparently was relying on was a source within the campaign that possibly they could change or could amend his position, which, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he has to come out and make it clearer, because, frankly, none of us is exactly sure what he's proposing at this point.
And politically speaking, is he better off at this point doubling down on the ban or backing off, because there are so many even Republicans who are very uncomfortable with that?
It's hard to say that him doubling down helps him. because he's got 70% unfavorable ratings in polling at this point. Anybody who wanted to say in the primaries that he was Teflon, he was maybe Teflon with the Republican primary voters, but he was certainly Velcro when it came to general election voters. And they were listening, they heard his policies, and he has to figure out a way, Republican leadership at least believes, that he needs to figure out a way to temper his tone and speak a little bit more clearly and a little bit more carefully when it comes to these issues.
Domenico, before I let you go, I want to ask you about the Veep stakes that's going on in the Democratic and Republican sides. Now, we saw Hillary Clinton with Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, yesterday campaigning for the first time together. A lot of talk about what that might mean for that campaign and whether that's a ticket. And we've talked about that. We also today heard from former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, who's been floated as a possible VP for Donald Trump. Here he is on Fox News this morning.
Hillary Clinton lies. Hillary Clinton lies all the time. She lies about emails. She lies about the Clinton Foundation. She lies about secret meetings in the State Department with donors. She lies about deals that are cut. She lies about her speeches to Goldman Sachs. And by the way, she lies about Benghazi. What's new? I mean, this is who she is. And if the American people are comfortable with a person that dishonest in the White House, she's a pretty formidable candidate.
Okay. I want to take the substance of that out for just one second to ask you on both sides, Domenico, who's at the top of the list for Veep?
Well, first of all, the 90s are back, man. Newt Gingrich, right. Hillary Clinton.
Right.
This is terrific. Look, I wouldn't be surprised if you've got Newt Gingrich on the ticket. Bob Corker has been mentioned, the senator from Tennessee. Jan Brewer, the governor, former governor of Arizona. On the Democratic side, I don't think it's going to be Elizabeth Warren. It's not going to be Bernie Sanders. More likely, a no-risk pick is the best way to go. The first rule is to do no harm. And someone like Tim Kaine is the most obvious choice. He's right
senator
on message.
Virginia.
Senator from Virginia. He's right on message with her. He balances that ticket out. So he's someone to look at. I'd throw in Tom Perez, who's the labor secretary.
Right.
The only issue with him is he's never had to stand on a debate stage.
Well, we will be watching. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, things may be shifting in politics, but the earth is crumbling in West Texas. Scientists from Southern Methodist University have new research that shows that the two massive sinkholes between the towns of Wink and Kermit are expanding. Years of drilling for oil and gas helped wash away the salt beds underneath the ground. And now there's concern that the pits could merge into one giant hole. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports.
These wounds in the West Texas desert have been around for years. The first hole opened up near an abandoned oil well on June 3, 1980. Then, 22 years later, about a mile away, the second one. From the sky, they look like high-caliber bullet holes. And from the ground, well, you're not actually allowed to get close enough to see.
It's pretty scary. It's just a big, huge pit.
Winkler County Sheriff George Keeley is one of the few who's peered over the edge.
It's like standing on the moon looking into a crater, you know, and you can see where, you know, it's just caved off. It's just broken off over the years more and more. And then when you look down there, you're looking at water.
And water is the problem.
If you've ever been out here in this part of West Texas, there are literally hundreds of thousands of wells, yeah. Oil wells and gas wells.
This is oil country and has been since the middle 1920s. For decades, drillers drilled deep down, injected water into the ground, and destabilized the earth. Now it's hot and dry, the water table is shrinking, and as that water sinks, thick layers of salt are dissolved far below the surface. It's like kicking the legs out from underneath a chair.
We could have another sinkhole or two or ten someday show up.
Keeley's prediction is backed up by the researchers at SMU. They use satellites to show the problem's getting worse. And that's saying something. The holes are already big. One's 361 feet across, the other is nearly three times larger, more than a couple football fields wide.
Maybe a football field and a half deep until you hit the water.
Researchers say a collapse could be catastrophic. In some places, the ground is sinking 5 inches a year.
In the cafes, of course, people talk about it all the time.
And if you lived in Wink or Kermit, Texas, you'd probably be talking about it too. A few years ago, roads near town started buckling under the weight of a couple thousand-pound trucks that work in the oil fields.
They're 80,000 pounds.
80,000 pounds, excuse me.
Yeah, and they're driving down the county roads adjacent to the sinkholes in the roads are sinking, and we have fissures in them now, you know, cracks. You know, that's the scariest part.
The companies that own the land have put up gates and fences around the holes. Sheriff Keeley has blocked off a few county roads, but there's still work that needs to get done. The pump jacks are still bobbing for oil. And no matter what you do, good luck with the looky-loos.
You have to literally trespass, go in through fences or over fences or under fences, whatever.
And do people do that?
Yeah, they do, actually. They do it more often than you'd think, and not just kids, grown-ups. Mm. One time I was out there because we had some people picnicking. When I ran them off, I went to look at the edge, and the water was full of ducks. It was the time of the year when the wildlife migrates south, and the ducks were down there. They didn't seem too concerned about it, but I was concerned about it. You know, if somebody would fall off of there, especially a child, it would be more than catastrophic.
Sheriff Keeley will arrest anyone he finds poking around out there, but he can't replace the salt that's washed away, and he can't prop up the earth that's falling down. So he doesn't really do much but watch and wait. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd on Solid Ground.
Do it again. 5, 6, 7, go.
And they're off. In the new movie, The Fitz, the Lionesses are a girls' drill team at a Cincinnati recreation center that specializes in dance forms like stand battle. That's call-and-response teamwork. That's half dance, half top that smackdown. We'll have some videos at hereandnow.org. So you'd think if someone were to make a movie using real members of the real Cincinnati-based Q Kids, it would be an action-packed thriller. We'd follow the girls, say, to a competition where they'd overcome obstacles and win. But for large swaths of the Fitz, nothing happens, except, thrillingly, we watch a young girl grow up. Royalty Hightower plays Tony. She's nine-ish, and in the film, she's a boxer like her brother who wanders into the Lionesses' practice room where girls begin having fits. What is it? The ancient Greeks thought hysteria was women's wombs moving through their bodies. In the film, authorities worry it's lead poisoning. But could it be something more akin to religious ecstasy? Joining us from Cincinnati Public Radio is the film's director and co-writer, Anna Rose Homer. Anna, welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
And with you there, the film star, the now 11-year-old Royalty Hightower. Royalty, wow, congratulations. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also in the studio, Marquisha Jones-Woods, associate producer of the film and founder and director of The Real Life Q Kids. Quisi, welcome.
Thank you.
And Anna, start with you, as the film did. We read that you'd been fascinated by historical cases of hysteria, and you were looking for a group to kind of maybe place a film around, and then you saw Stand Battle. But tell us more about this, your early fascination with hysteria.
Yeah, I was just fascinated by these historical cases, and I know that there have been many plays and films and stories that centered around these moments as kind of allegories for female coming-of-age stories, and I really wanted to take that and lift it and place it in a dance film. That was really the initial seed of the film.
I talked about its dreaminess. It's, you know, that it lingers. At its heart is this furious dance form, but a lot of the times the choreography seems to be of packs of girls just going through their day.
Yeah, we consider it a dance film from frame one to closing credits. Sometimes that's traditional dance sequences. We had the pleasure of working with Mariah and Shariah Jones on all of the drill choreography in the film. But we also worked on the choreography of the other scenes. We brought on modern dancer Celia Rawson Hall as a movement consultant. And we really made these tableaus with bodies in every single frame. And one of the beautiful things about the Q Kids is they're nationally ranked dancers. And so approaching all the scenes through dance was really a way to break down the emotional content of the film. And they're just such strong dancers that came really effortlessly to them.
It's just stunning. I mean, we might be sitting there with 100 girls waiting for a practice or something, and you're so conscious of how beautiful they are and in their stances and how they're playing with each other's hair and trying to strike a pose, or maybe the younger ones just sitting there, you know, with their tongues hanging out, watching the older girls. There is motion even in that.
Yeah, I think that through motion, each of those girls is telling the world something about themselves.
Yeah. Quisi, Marquisha Jones-Woods, the two Jones sisters that Anna just mentioned are your daughters and work with your troupe there in Cincinnati. How would you explain what this is, what you do?
Well, it's an organization that I started 30 years ago to give the kids in my community, the inner city, something positive to do to try to stay clear of the crime and violence that was going on in our neighborhood. So that's how Q Kids came about.
And Tony, you are a member of the Q Kids, right?
Yes.
What are you doing when you dance?
I don't think about it while I'm dancing because that'll make me nervous and then I'll probably, mess up. I just, hear the music and start moving.
Yeah. Lots of whipping of the necks and, if I were to do it, something would break. Is it fighting, too? Because some of it feels like maybe it's acting out a fight, a smackdown that you don't really mean, but it gets some emotion out.
Yeah, you can explain it that way. It's like a fight back and forth, but a fight that's not violent. Just a way of expressing yourself through dance. And at the end, you can hug and laugh about it after you lose. Only if you lose, though.
Well, and your girls have won. Can you think of it's all on YouTube. Can you think of a moment? We'll play some of it and then post it. But what will we be seeing?
What we're listening to now is them going against each other in a practice form where you have the smalls competing against the older girls.
Hey, you, come here. Stop.
This is a tough fight because the smalls never want to give in to the older girls.
There is sort of a fraternal, or sorority kind of feel to it, that you are making your way up from the smalls to the bigger royalty.
Talls. The smalls to the talls.
The smalls to the talls. Okay. And royalty in the film, you play the very smallest, somebody making their way in. But I'm stunned to hear you speaking because that's not who you are at all in the film. In the film, you're a very quiet boxer who can't really dance that well. How'd you do that?
I had to practice a lot because I'm not Tony. We have something in common.
Like what?
Well, we have dancing in common, and...
But not at first. Babe, Tony, no offense, can't really... She's like a pickup stick. She can't.
But really, when I first started, it was hard for me because, I wasn't used to that type of dancing. It's and you had to stretch and stuff, and I wasn't used to that because, when I was at home, I only did, the dances on YouTube and stuff. I never did, drill, and I wasn't serious about it. We were always playing. Yeah.
When Royalty first started dancing, she did experience some of the things that you see Tony experiencing in the film as far as just trying to learn the routines and not being able to get it. So she does have a lot in common with that character.
She had to unlearn what she now knows.
Right.
Yeah. Anna, what's the bigger comment here? They have the fits enter in these hysterical episodes. What is it? Is it the girls not wanting to move from this joyous space into their older years? What is it, metaphor for something?
I think a lot of people bring their own interpretation to the film, but one of the things that we're trying to say is it's about community, not conformity. That you can join a team, and at first it can be really scary and you think you're losing some of yourself. And it's really scary to look yourself in the mirror and really see who you are. But through that vulnerability and through opening up, through kind of giving up control, you can access something that you couldn't access on your own. And there's a real power in that.
And Kwesi, what do you see? Obviously you haven't had, your girls have hysterical fits. But what do you see happening when there's it's not just a community, it's a carefully outlined community, one in which there are demands made on you. You know, the older girls are in charge, and someone could say, wow, this is bordering on, being mean girls. Or you could say, no, this is a discipline and a respect. Let's listen.
If you're going to show up, just know there's work to do. We expect you here for 3-hour practices 3 times a week. At home, practice. At school, practice. Stop thinking like an individual and start thinking like a team.
What do you see happening to the girls in your group?
I see the older girls taking charge. Doing what older girls do. Be bossy and a little aggressive at times, but they know their limits and they know what's acceptable and what's not in my organization. So I see a sisterhood there, sort of like you said before, the sorority type. In the movie, it seems a little mean. We don't actually operate like that. That's in the film.
That's fiction.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it gives girls an opportunity to have a structure that's about them and not how they might be appealing to boys. It's about them performing and being part of something.
That's correct.
Royalty?
Yes.
Like I said, your character is not quite sure if she wants to cross over into this world, but you are fully in it in real life. What does it do for you to be part of that?
They're like our real sisters because, like, everybody helps each other out. If you don't have something, they'll give it to you. You just borrow from them. If you need something, you just tell them. It's like your real sisters. Like, you don't need to hide anything from them because...
your family.
Yeah.
It's family.
Yeah. That's Q Kids founder and director Markecia Jones-Woods. And Royalty Hightower, a member of Q Kids and star of the new film The Fitz, which was directed and co-written by Anna Rose Homer, her first venture. And Anna, you know, throw some bouquets at you. Don't get hurt. The New York Times, a movie that can feel like a memory. Transporting, dreamy, beautifully syncopated. The Wall Street Journal, a motion picture in the truest sense. Never seen anything quite like it. Loved every one of its 72 minutes. How are you doing?
It's wild, overwhelming. But every, you know, sitting here in the studio, the three of us together, there's just like a feeling of gratitude in the air. Not only that we were able to make this film together, but that it's connecting to people. We're just continuing to be in awe of the film and its life, because now it's alive on its own. Mm. And it's a really magical thing.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for
having
us.
Thank you.
This is music from the soundtrack to The Fitz. So for more information on how to see it, because it's being released slowly over the next month, and again, to watch videos of the real Q Kids performing in Cincinnati, where the film was made, go to hereandnow.org. You're listening to Here and Now.
Today, Volkswagen announced it has reached a settlement with U.S. regulators, 44 states' attorneys general, and a coalition of private plaintiffs. The German car company's U.S. subsidiary will pay $14.7 billion to settle claims related to its diesel scandal, in which VW was found to have designed its vehicles to evade air pollution tests. For more, we're joined by The Wall Street Journal's Jason Bellini. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And tell us first about this settlement and what the terms are.
Well, I mean, first of all, this is the largest ever civil settlement for an automaker, and it doesn't include other possible civil or criminal financial penalties that the company could later face. What the company's saying, though, is that, quote from the chief executive of Volkswagen, Matthias Müller, "We know that we still have a great deal of work to do to earn back the trust of the American people, but this is an opportunity to finally start putting this scandal behind it and moving on."
And what does it mean for the owners of the affected VW vehicles?
So here's what it means. They can either sell back or terminate leases of the affected vehicles. They can have their cars made compliant with environmental regulations, but they'll have to wait for the automaker to get government approval for the right modification. So they have to wait on that. So again, sell, terminate your lease, or get it modified.
And this settlement takes care of claims from the Department of Justice, the Federal Trade Commission, the state of California, and many others. Is it possible that there would be more cases coming against VW, or is that it legally?
Oh, yeah. No, it's not the end of its problems. Federal prosecutors are conducting a criminal probe, and there could be a heavy financial penalty with that. There are also lawsuits that are ongoing in Europe, where there are about 8.5 million Volkswagen vehicles affected. There's also a handful of states they're investigating, and that could result in substantial additional penalties. You also have several lawsuits filed in Germany on behalf of investors, but the German courts haven't ruled yet on whether to allow class action suits to go forward.
Wow, I want to ask,
an expensive problem for this company.
Well, and there's another company that is in the news, another European company that I want to ask you about, and that is IKEA, and a major flaw in its product. The Swedish home furnishings company is recalling 29 million chests and dressers after dozens of children were injured and at least three killed when the furniture fell on them. The Consumer Product Safety Commission called the furniture inherently very dangerous and unstable. What is IKEA doing about this?
What's IKEA doing about it? Well, they're going to have to refund customers for these chests and dressers, ones that are made between January of 2002 and June of 2016. Consumers with the chests and dressers made prior to that are also eligible for a partial store credit. I did some looking, and it turns out I've got one of these IKEA dressers. So I was looking around, and there aren't any details yet for folks like me and 29 million other people who've got these pieces of furniture on how you go about doing this. But they also send people out to your house to mount the chest to the wall.
To wall anchor them. Yeah, you can't think of that many other things you could possibly do to keep something like this from happening. But obviously a dangerous thing that has caused many injuries and at least a few deaths. IKEA issuing a recall there of 29 million chests and dressers in the United States. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks as always.
Thank you.
European leaders are meeting this week to figure out how to manage a British departure from the European Union. The realities of what a Brexit will mean are beginning to sink in across Europe. Joining us now for a look at the reaction in France is Annick Cojon, who is a reporter at large at Le Monde. She joins us via Skype from Paris. Annick, welcome back.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, how are people in France feeling about the Brexit vote?
My God, everybody's talking about that. Of course, it's a huge discussion. People are shocked and stunned. It was a surprise, a total surprise. We didn't expect that. We knew the debate in the UK was tough, wild, full of hatreds, included violence. We could see most of the press was in favor of the out, with incredible propaganda in the tabloids based on the migrants, on the fear, making the EU responsible for everything bad in people's life, etc. We knew also that the British have never been good partners in the European Union. They were reluctant to enter. They were imperialistic, nostalgic of the empire, of the good old days, etc. And I don't know, we knew that the British politicians were all playing their own and selfish part, and particularly Boris Johnson. But we thought reason would prevail at the last minute. And of course, now, after a couple of days, people are really upset and tend to say, okay, you want to leave? Just leave. Stay isolated. You're already regretting your foolish decision. Go back to the past. Refuse to see the future. Welcome to your disillusion. Look at the huge petition claiming for a new referendum. This is ridiculous, you know? And some humorists and entertainers are joking, Boris Johnson not even knowing what to do and looking surprised, looking for a delay, asking for a delay and preferring to play cricket during the weekend. And I should also say that all the French yesterday were feeling so happy to see the British football team being kicked off from the European Championship. That was very funny. In the streets of Paris, you could see people yelling, etc., British are out, etc. So it's bizarre. And also I should say also that we think of the young people from the UK, and young French people are also very sad. And we have the impression that the old people from England have stolen the European dreams of the young. You know, there were 70% of the young who voted for Remain. And I shouldn't even talk, in fact, of the dream, because it was reality for all those people. All of them have never known of Europe without the UK. So it's bizarre, and it looks unfair, and it's really upsetting, especially for the young generation.
But do you think that it means an eventual end of the Union, or are countries like France, like Germany, even like Spain and Italy and Greece going to be able to stay together after one country, I mean, assuming they actually do go through with it and Brexit, and there are questions about that, but after one leaves, will the rest stay together?
Oh, well, I hope so. I think so, because it has been a big dream, as I was saying. It was also the consequence and a big ambition and the consequence of the war. You know, our history has always been complicated and our past with the British. There were lots of rivalry, disdain, battles, but World War II is still in our mind. We forget Chamberlain, but not Churchill, who is an European hero And we thank the British with their Royal Navy, the Royal Air Force for their help, etc. And most of them learned English by going in British family, you know, for summertime and all that kind of thing. So we can't imagine this would provoke the end of Europe. There were so many links. And among the rest of Europe, of course, we still want to maintain this unity. But it's going to be complicated. We need something to be done in the next days, within the next weeks. And the fact that the British now seem to be reluctant, seem to be very slow, they want to maybe to wait for October. We can't allow that. We need to be fast because we need to show that Europe is still awake and fully alive. And it could be dramatic. So that's why all these meetings today, tomorrow with Holland and Merkel and all the others are terribly important. They have to send signs that show Europe is awake and they need to give us a vision of Europe. But you're right. It's a big crisis. Lots of people could ask for some other referendum, of course. The idea of the British and also populist people like Marine Le Pen from the extreme right are trying to take advantage, take the benefit of what happened. And she's so happy. She congratulates the British and puts Union Jack on her Twitter account, etc. And there's a lot of populists who really want to take advantage. So it's a very dangerous moment. The poison has entered our minds. And you're right. Many fears of contagion will spread. I don't think so, but there is a risk. This is why we need a vision to be given, and we need some generosity, and we need to reaffirm the position, what unified us, and we don't want the biggest union. We don't want any other country to enter. This probably has been too fast, and we followed sometimes our goal. But yes, it's a very dangerous moment.
Well, let me ask you about Marine Le Pen, the head of the right-wing National Front Party in France, who's been outspoken in her support of Brexit and her scorn for the EU. She sees it as the start of a wave of anti-EU sentiment in Europe, an anti-EU movement in Europe. Is it possible that we'll see a Frexit, a movement for France to exit the European Union, a serious movement?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Maybe I don't want it, but no, seriously, I don't think so. I think most of the politicians will not take a risk and don't want to play with this dangerous weapon of referendum. They are not irresponsible as probably Boris Johnson has been. Of course, there is Marine Le Pen, and there she's popular now, and of course she has so many contradictions in our speech, in her speech. But I don't think the politicians will follow. There is a temptation, you know. Of course, lots of people are not happy with Europe, and they are they don't know, they don't understand Europe, they don't understand what do so many people work, why so many people work in Brussels. There are so many, civil servants there, highly paid, etc., not paying taxes. You know, there's all these stories about is it useful? What does the European Commission do, etc., etc.? All these new taxes, all these new norms that are imposed by Europe. So, of course, there could be a movement against Europe. But strongly, I can't imagine the French going in that direction. There are too many links. We are facing so many dangers in this world. You know, we're facing terrorism, and we know Belgium, France, and even UK, in fact, know very deeply what terrorism means now. The last faces have been terrifying in Paris. place and in our countries. There is an economic crisis. There is, you know, we're facing Russian dictatorship in a way, the new Chinese development, this huge crisis of immigration. And we need to be united. We need to have a voice in the world and to be united. So I can't imagine one second that we could go in that direction.
That's Annick Cojan, a reporter at large at Le Monde, joining us from Paris. Annick, always great to hear from you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. I was happy to do that.
A Georgia teenager is the latest person to be cited for a car accident that may be related to the popular Snapchat phone app. Now, you've probably heard of Snapchat. It allows users to take pictures and videos and send them to friends who see them for just a few seconds before they disappear. But you can grab screenshots. We'll have some at herenow.org. And even when the pics disappear, they leave traces in technology. And now there are questions about when they're being taken, the pictures, specifically when the speed filter is used. It lets people take pictures and videos while they're driving, showing their speed. And police say 19-year-old Crystal McGee was driving 107 miles per hour when she collided with Maynard Wentworth in a crash that left him permanently brain damaged. And a lawsuit alleges that Crystal was using the speed filter at the time of the crash. Snapchat denies that's true, but other accidents thought to be associated with the app include three people burned alive in Philadelphia when their car crashed into a parked tractor trailer filled with chemicals, and a woman in Brazil who broadcast her accident over Snapchat. She was going 110 miles an hour. Katie Bassett is with Safer America. That's a safety advocacy group. She recently wrote the online article, Snapchat's Facelift, What Dangers Are Associated for Drivers, and joins us by Skype. Katie, tell us a little more about the speed filter.
It is a basic filter that they've had for a while. And when you're either taking a picture or a video, it shows how fast you're moving. So I could be on a bike, I could be on a train, I could be just simply walking, and it will pick up the speed that you are going.
Okay, so on a bike is dangerous, but in a car while driving is, you know, horrendous. There is a little warning on the app, don't do while driving, but young people overlook a lot of things. And we have seen examples of people driving up their speed in order to get that Snapchat.
Right, definitely. And I think for the people and the users that are using it, it's just more of the need to capture the perfect moment just at the right time. So if they want to get that certain speed up, they're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, so there's this, and these lawsuits are pending, and we'll see what happens. But you say there are other concerns with the newest version of the app, Snapchat 2.0. Tick through some.
The first one that I touched on was that the stories auto-advance. And so you, as a user, don't even need to click through to watch each story. They just automatically start and continue and continue. And I was speaking to Jeff Rosenbaum, who is a personal injury attorney in Philadelphia, and he basically went over that just taking your eyes off the road for 5 seconds equates to the length of a football field. And so when you have these stories that are going over and over again, you could be watching them for up to a minute. And a minute on the road equates to, I don't even know how many miles, but it's,
well, that's six,
you know,
football
pretty
fields.
Terrifying.
Yeah. And as you say, it's right there. So it's hard to tear your eyes away from it. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's the need, I think, for a lot of people in our generation, they call it the fear of missing out.
FOMO, fear of missing out. Well, it not only could be that, you know, you are endangered and distracted, but what you could be seeing pop up is a friend of yours, you know, about to crash because they're using the Snapchat speed filter.
Exactly.
Yeah. Then there's video calling.
Right. It's very similar to FaceTiming, and their goal is to kind of take over the basic phone features and make this Snapchat, you know, the app for all, essentially. So video calling works the exact same as FaceTiming, and, you know, we all know the dangers associated with that and driving. You're visually watching someone talk as you're driving.
GIFs, we know those little short dancing videos we see on the internet. What's different about Snapchat?
So it's same thing. You're making that small GIF that's able, you know, a quick couple seconds, it's able to replay over and over again. And with Snapchat, you want to get that perfect GIF and you want to get that perfect picture. And so you might be trying over and over again to get this perfect moment, which could take 5 seconds, it could take 15. And regardless of the 5 or 15 seconds, if you're driving and trying to do that, you're completely 100% distracted from the road and what's going on in front of you.
Yeah. And then there's stickers.
So stickers are very similar to the emojis on texting. They just came out with over 200 new stickers that'll go into the message or into the video. And so, you know, with 200 options, users are just scrolling through and through and not paying attention to what's on the road and to other drivers, other cars around them. And you know, that's a big, big distraction.
Well, all these distractions sound a lot like distractions from any use of a smartphone in the car. We know that, you know, the same thing is true of texting or anything else that takes you away for even 10 seconds. But what's really frightening, though, is this idea that you have these speed filters. Who wouldn't want to have a picture of themselves driving 100 miles an hour? Is there any consideration of getting rid of that? Or
You know, I've actually heard talk that they are putting a cap on a speed limit. But even then, I mean, you're not solving the entire problem. People will still get up to 60 miles an hour, the capped speed. So as far as solving the problem, I mean, I definitely think the Snapchat team can come up with ways for, you know, safer measures. But I also think it lies within the drivers. If you're not paying attention on the road and you're the one that's going to be causing these accidents, should you even be driving?
Yeah. Well, again, Snapchat has said that their records indicate that the young girl we started talking about, Crystal McGee, was not using the speed filter when there was this horrific accident. But there's lawsuits, and we will follow to see what happens here. Katie Bassett with Safer America. That's an advocacy group that focuses on youth safety. Her online article, we'll link you to it, is Snapchat's Facelift, What Dangers Are Associated for Drivers. Katie, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Robin.
Okay. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.